If we were coming up with an alternative title for the Bible, we could call it A Tale of Two Cities. From beginning to end, the Bible traces the story of two cities, the city of God and the city that sets itself up in opposition to God. A Tale of Two Cities. But can we be more specific than that? Well, if we read the Bible from beginning to end, we would find that Jerusalem, or Zion, does double duty in the Bible. Jerusalem is, of course, a city in Judah, a city made of bricks and mortar, which can be located on a map. In many ways, that city and its people are just like any other city. Business goes on there, relationships are played out, good things happen there, and bad things too. But in the Bible, Jerusalem or Zion also comes to represent the city of God, the place where God's rule is welcomed and his blessing is experienced. More specifically, we could call that the New Jerusalem, to distinguish it from the bricks and mortar city of Jerusalem. In the book of Isaiah, as we've been going through Isaiah, we've already been given some glimpses of the New Jerusalem, God's place where his people enjoy fellowship with him. And the Bible will continue to talk about that city of God and develop that picture right till the very end of the book of Revelation. So if Jerusalem represents the city of God, what about the other city? The city that sets itself up in opposition to God. Does the Bible have another name for that city? Well, yes, it does. In the Bible, the city of Babylon also does double duty. It features in the Bible as a city made of bricks and mortar, which can be located on a map. We've heard in recent weeks about Assyria. Babylon is further south in modern-day Iraq. But in the Bible, Babylon also comes to represent the city that sets itself up in opposition to God. The origin of that comes from the incident we read about earlier, the Tower of Babel in Genesis chapter 11. In Hebrew, the spelling of Babel and Babylon are exactly the same. We're told in Genesis 11, the people decided to build a city, which in itself is not a bad thing at all. But their ambition was to build a tower in their city that reached to the heavens so that they could make a name for themselves. They wanted to storm God's throne room and put themselves in God's place. That was their ambition. And from then on, Babylon does double duty in the Bible. It's a city on the map, and it symbolizes those who set themselves up in opposition to God. That's why in the New Testament, Rome is referred to as Babylon. By New Testament times, Babylon, the city on the map, was long gone. But Rome was the latest manifestation of the spirit first seen in Babylon or Babel. Humanity's desire to make a name for themselves. And in that sense, you and I live in Babylon today. And when the book of Revelation describes the final downfall of Babylon, which we also read, when Revelation describes that, it is describing the end of those who oppose God, whatever city on the map they happen to live in. Now, why do we need to know all that? We need to know it because without that understanding in our minds, we will not make head nor tail of our passage this morning. We are in the book of Isaiah still, and this morning we come to a new section in the book. Chapters 1 to 12 contained several glimpses of the New Jerusalem. Those chapters also told us about God's King, Emmanuel. His reign will bring about a glorious new creation, we were told. So far, we've heard a fair bit about the city of God. What about the other city? That's what we come to this morning. Chapters 13 to 27 of Isaiah are a series of messages about the nations of the earth. Lots of different nations are going to be mentioned in these chapters. But this series of messages begins with a long message about Babylon. And if we've been following from the beginning of Isaiah, that will seem very odd to us. Because Babylon has not featured in the book so far. We've heard a lot about Assyria, but nothing at all about Babylon. And that is what we would expect. Because at this point in history, Assyria is the dominant world power. Babylon has not yet risen to prominence in the world. It's not yet a major superpower. But if we have grasped the significance Babylon has in the storyline of the whole Bible, then it makes sense that Isaiah starts this series of messages about the nations with a message about Babylon. Babylon symbolizes the pride and arrogance of the nations. It's the perfect introduction to this section on the nations. So with that in mind, we're going to read chapters 13 and 14. We'll take the time to read all of it, and then we'll come back and pick up on some of the details and see how this fits with what we've just been saying and what significance it has for us today. If you're using one of the Green Church Bibles, that's page 698, and in the larger print Bibles, 1079. Isaiah 13 and 14. A prophecy against Babylon that Isaiah, son of Amoz, saw. Raise a banner on a bare hilltop, shout to them, beckon to them to enter the gates of the nobles. I have commanded those I prepared for battle. I have summoned my warriors to carry out my wrath, those who rejoice in my triumph. Listen, a noise on the mountains, like that of a great multitude. Listen. An uproar among the kingdoms, like nations massing together. The Lord Almighty is mustering an army for war. They come from faraway lands, from the ends of the heavens. The Lord and the weapons of his wrath to destroy the whole country. Wail, for the day of the Lord is near. It will come like destruction from the Almighty. Because of this, all hands will go limp. Every heart will melt with fear. Terror will seize them. Pain and anguish will grip them. They will writhe like a woman in labor. They will look aghast at each other, their faces aflame. See, the day of the Lord is coming. A cruel day with wrath and fierce anger to make the land desolate and destroy the sinners within it. The stars of heaven and their constellations will not show their light. The rising sun will be darkened and the moon will not give its light. I will punish the world for its evil, the wicked for their sins. I will put an end to the arrogance of the haughty and will humble the pride of the ruthless. I will make people scarcer than pure gold, more rare than the gold of Ophir. Therefore, I will make the heavens tremble and the earth will shake from its place at the wrath of the Lord Almighty in the day of his burning anger. Like a hunted gazelle, like sheep without a shepherd, they will all return to their own people. They will flee to their native land. Whoever is captured will be thrust through. All who are caught will fall by the sword. Their infants will be dashed to pieces before their eyes. Their houses will be looted and their wives violated. See, I will stir up against them the Medes, who do not care for silver and have no delight in gold. Their bows will strike down the young man. They will have no mercy on infants, nor will they look with compassion on children. Babylon, the jewel of kingdoms, the pride and glory of the Babylonians, will be overthrown by God like Sodom and Gomorrah. She will never be inhabited or lived in through all generations. There no nomads will pitch their tents. There no shepherds will rest their flocks. But desert creatures will lie there. Jackals will fill her houses. There the owls will dwell, and there the wild goats will leap about. Hyenas will inhabit her strongholds, jackals her luxurious palaces. Her time is at hand, and her days will not be prolonged. The Lord will have compassion on Jacob. Once again, he will choose Israel and will settle them in their own land. Foreigners will join them and unite with the descendants of Jacob. Nations will take them and bring them to their own place. And Israel will take possession of the nations and will make them male and female servants in the Lord's land. They will make captives of their captors and rule over their oppressors. On the day the Lord gives you relief from your suffering and turmoil and from the harsh labor forced on you, you will take up this taunt against the king of Babylon. How the oppressor has come to an end. How his fury has ended. The Lord has broken the rod of the wicked, the scepter of the rulers, which in anger struck down peoples with unceasing blows and in fury subdued nations with relentless aggression. All the lands are at rest and at peace. They break into singing. Even the junipers and the cedars of Lebanon gloat over you and say, now that you who have been laid low, no one comes to cut us down. The realm of the dead below is all astir to meet you at your coming. It rouses the spirits of the departed to greet you. All those who were leaders in the world, it makes them rise from their thrones, all those who are kings over the nations. They will all respond. They will say to you, you also have become weak, as we are. You've become like us. All your pomp has been brought down to the grave, along with the noise of your harps. Maggots are spread out beneath you, and worms cover you. How you have fallen from heaven, morning star, son of the dawn. You have been cast down to the earth, you who once laid low the nations. You said in your heart, I will ascend to the heavens. I will raise my throne above the stars of God. I will sit enthroned in the mount of assembly on the utmost heights of Mount Zephon. I will ascend above the tops of the clouds. I will make myself like the Most High. But you are brought down to the realm of the dead, to the depths of the pit. Those who see you stare at you. They ponder your fate. Is this the man who shook the earth and made kingdoms tremble? The man who made the world a wilderness, who overthrew its cities and would not let his captives go home? All the kings of the nations lie in state, each in his own tomb. But you are cast out of your tomb like a rejected branch. You are covered with the slain, with those pierced by the sword, those who descend to the stones of the pit. Like a corpse trampled underfoot, you will not join them in burial, for you have destroyed your land and killed your people. Let the offspring of the wicked never be mentioned again. Prepare a place to slaughter his children for the sins of their ancestors. They are not to rise to inherit the land and cover the earth with their cities. I will rise up against them, declares the Lord Almighty. I will wipe out Babylon's name and survivors, her offspring and descendants, declares the Lord. I will turn her into a place for owls and a swampland. I will sweep her with the broom of destruction, declares the Lord Almighty. The Lord Almighty has sworn, surely as I have planned, so it will be, and as I have purposed, so it will happen. I will crush the Assyrian in my land. On my mountains I will trample him down. His yoke will be taken from my people and his burden removed from their shoulders. This is the plan determined for the whole world. This is the hand stretched out over all nations. For the Lord Almighty has purposed, and who can thwart him? His hand is stretched out, and who can turn it back? This is God's word. And it falls into two sections. The first section gives us the big picture, and the second gives us a closer look. It takes us to the heart of what is going on. First, in chapter 13, we're given the big picture, the inevitable downfall of the other city. We've said that Babylon does double duty in the Bible. And it does double duty in this passage. Because there's no doubt we are being told here about the fall of the Babylonian Empire. Babylon is not yet the dominant world power, but it will rise to power in the years after this prophecy. And it will fall. In this passage, we're even told who will be responsible for that: the Medes. But it's also obvious as we read this, the description we're given here is about more than the downfall of a city on the Euphrates River. This is about more than the Medes and Persians who took over from the Babylonians. This is about the downfall of all empires and civilizations and powers that set themselves up in opposition to God. This is about the downfall of every new attempt by humanity to recreate Babel by making a name for ourselves, including the attempt made by Assyria. You may have noticed, as we read this, Assyria got a tiny little mention near the end of chapter 14, just marking the fact that Assyria is one in a long line of Babylons. The Assyrians are just the latest manifestation of the spirit of Babel. And they will fall like every other manifestation of Babel. But here in chapter 13, we do start with the historical city of Babylon. Look at it again in chapter 13, verse 1. A prophecy against Babylon that Isaiah, son of Amoz, saw. Raise a banner on a bare hilltop. Shout to them, beckon to them to enter the gates of the nobles. I have commanded those I prepared for battle. I have summoned my warriors to carry out my wrath, those who rejoice in my triumph. Listen, a noise on the mountains like that of a great multitude. Listen, an uproar among the kingdoms like nations massing together. The Lord Almighty is mustering an army for war. They come from faraway lands, from the ends of the heavens. The earth, the Lord, and the weapons of his wrath will destroy the whole country. This is very disorientating when we read it. We read it and wonder, what's going on here? Who's involved in this? Where are we? Well, verse 6 tells us, this is the day of the Lord. The day of the Lord is used throughout Scripture to refer to the Lord's intervention in history. His intervention to establish his justice and deal with evil. According to the Bible, there will be many, many days of the Lord throughout history. And there will be one final climactic day of the Lord. All the smaller days of the Lord are foretastes or previews of that final day of the Lord, when the Lord's justice will no longer be opposed, when all evil will be completely dealt with once and for all. Here, Isaiah is describing one minor day of the Lord that previews the final day. If you look down to verse 17 just for a moment, the army we just read about is named for us. It is the Medes, who do not care for silver and have no delight in gold. In other words, you cannot buy these people off. They don't care about getting wealthy. They just want to conquer. If the list of human ambitions boils down to money, sex, and power, the Medes are all about power. And verse 19 clarifies, this is about the Medes overthrowing Babylon. That took place in 539 BC, about 180 years after Isaiah proclaimed this prophecy. You can read the details in Daniel chapter 5. So that is what this is about, but it is not all this is about. Look back up to verse 10. This is the Lord speaking. The stars of heaven and their constellations will not show their light. The rising sun will be darkened and the moon will not give its light. I will punish the world for its evil, the wicked for their sins. I will put an end to the arrogance of the haughty and will humble the pride of the ruthless. I will make people scarcer than pure gold, more rare than the gold of Ophir. Therefore, I will make the heavens tremble, and the earth will shake from its place at the wrath of the Lord Almighty in the day of his burning anger. If this is about nothing more than the Medes marching into Babylon, then this is a little over the top. But in fact, the Lord is explaining the day he intervenes to bring his judgment on the historical city of Babylon, that will be a preview of his judgment on the world, the other city that opposes the city of God. And very significantly, when Jesus Christ spoke about that final day of the Lord, he did something very similar to what's going on here. In Matthew chapter 24, Jesus began with a description of another minor day of the Lord, the destruction of the temple in Jerusalem by the Romans. Jesus predicted that, but he also quoted Isaiah chapter 13, verse 10, to point to the final climactic day of the Lord. I encourage you later to read Matthew 24 for yourself. People read Jesus' words there and they wonder, is Jesus talking about the downfall of the temple or is he talking about the end of the world? The answer is both. Jesus was following the pattern of Isaiah 13. He shows that by quoting from Isaiah 13. And the description here does not make pleasant reading. It doesn't make pleasant reading in Matthew 24 either. Here, verse 16 mentions infants dashed to pieces, wives violated. Throughout history, as human beings, we marvel, we are astounded at situations where human evil breaks out in these kind of horrible, horrible things. But in reality, that is just human sin running its full course. We ought to marvel, we ought to be astounded that most of the time, God graciously restrains the full tendencies of sin. When God removes his restraining hand, sin runs rife. Its full consequences are seen. And they're ugly. If that is true in history, what will it be like at the end of history? At the final day of the Lord? That is not something you and I want to be part of. It is something we want to be delivered from by finding refuge now in the city of God, taking our place among those who love God. The other city is not a good or a safe place to be. It is not good to side with the opponents of God. Throughout history, every manifestation of Babylon falls. And in the end, there will be no more manifestations of Babylon left. The other city will be forever destroyed. That's pictured here in verses 20 to 22 of Isaiah 13. The city is described as a broken down ruin with wild animals prowling through it, looking for prey. The same picture appears towards the end of Isaiah 14. It appears again in Revelation 18. And it is a long way from the renewed, perfected creation we saw last week in Isaiah 11. We saw there, even in that picture, even a little child could play safely in the midst of lions and cobras. A place of peace and security. A place to flourish. But here, they are just ruins, picked over by owls and jackals. And there are no children here playing at all. That is the destiny of every power, every regime that opposes God. In the end, they will be nothing but ruins. That is the big picture. And now the second section of our passage gives us a closer look. It shows us the pathetic pride at the heart of the other city. Chapter 14 starts with a brief reminder of what we saw last week in chapter 11, the promise that God will bring about a new exodus. He will gather his people out of the other city and into his new Jerusalem. And in verse 3, God's people are told, "On the day the Lord gives you relief from your suffering and turmoil and from the harsh labor forced on you, you will take up this taunt against the king of Babylon." The word taunt is normally translated as proverb. Proverbs are usually short sayings that give an important insight. So, for example, there is a way that appears to be right, but in the end it leads to death. That's a proverb. A short saying that gives an important insight. The Old Testament book of Proverbs is full of them. But what follows here is longer than a short saying. We might think of it as a parable. It's an extended description that gives an important insight. So why has it been translated here as taunt? Well, what comes next is in the form of a funeral lament, a speech commemorating someone's death. But where funeral laments are normally sad, they're normally full of regret that the person has gone, this one is full of relief. In a way, it celebrates the downfall of this king of Babylon. That's why it's called a taunt. But which king of Babylon is in mind here? We're not told. He's not named. And considering what we learned in chapter 13, it's best to understand this king as representing every figure who arrogantly defies God. Every figure who tramples on others to try to raise himself higher or herself. It includes the historical kings of Babylon, of course, but plenty of others as well. This king embodies the spirit at the heart of the other city. He shows us what makes the other city tick. Look how this poetic parable starts in the middle of verse 4. How the oppressor has come to an end. How his fury has ended. The Lord has broken the rod of the wicked, the scepter of the rulers, which in anger struck down peoples with unceasing blows, and in fury subdued nations with relentless aggression. All the lands are at rest and at peace. They break into singing. Even the junipers and the cedars of Lebanon gloat over you and say, "Now that you have been laid low, no one comes to cut us down." This is celebrating the end of oppression. And notice who is speaking there at the end. The trees. We saw a picture last week of creation once it had been liberated from its bondage. Here we have creation showing its relief that its oppressor has been laid low. Today, we are very, very tuned in to environmental issues. But the Bible was tuned in long before we were. In the first chapter of the Bible, humanity was given the responsibility of stewarding God's creation, ruling it well for God's sake. But when humanity chose to rebel against God, it was not just humanity that suffered. The rest of creation did as well. Because humanity abused not only other humans, but the resources of the earth as well. And it's God-defying pride, humanity ends up exploiting the earth instead of stewarding it. The other city, Babylon, is no friend of creation. Creation will rejoice when Babylon is gone. It is only in the New Jerusalem that creation will flourish as it was always intended to flourish. So far, so good. But now this parable in the form of a funeral speech gets really interesting. Because what's described next is the king of Babylon's arrival in the underworld, the afterlife. Look at verse 9 of chapter 14. The realm of the dead below is all astir to meet you at your coming. It rouses the spirits of the departed to greet you. All those who are leaders in the world, it makes them rise from their thrones. All those who are kings over the nations, they will all respond. They will say to you, you also have become weak as we are. You've become like us. All your pomp has been brought down to the grave. Along with the noise of your harps, maggots are spread out beneath you and worms cover you. We've identified this already as a parable. It's intended to give us an important insight in a very striking way. That's what Jesus' parables were like. And that means, just like with Jesus' parables, we are not to press every little detail here and assume that's the way things really are. For example, in Luke chapter 16, Jesus himself told a parable about the afterlife. In that parable, Abraham, who was in God's presence, was having a conversation with a man in the fire of hell. Was Jesus saying the afterlife is exactly like that? With people in those two places calling back and forwards to one another? Probably not. Actually, the point of the parable was to show how impassable the gulf is between one place and the other. And similarly here, we're probably not supposed to assume people who were kings on earth are given thrones in the afterlife to sit on. This is an imaginative visit to the underworld, a parable. And the point of it is, human pride is pathetic. It's pathetic because in the end, even the most feared rulers end up rulers of nothing. They end up in the same place as those they conquered. On the same level as those they conquered. They end up in the grave alongside the enemies they sent to the grave. They end up exchanging their royal robes for maggots and worms. What a bedspread for a proud king to end up with. And actually, the end of verse 11 is another clue. We're not supposed to press all the details here. Are these verses talking about rotting physically in the grave? Worms and maggots? Or are they talking about a spirit world, as verse 9 seems to suggest? Well, the answer to that question is, we're not supposed to press all the details. Instead, we're supposed to hear the message. Even the most proud and exalted ruler on this earth is no stronger than anyone else. In the end, they will be brought just as low as everyone else. There are lots of things we don't know about the future life, but we do know that. Then in verses 12 to 15, we hear about the massive discrepancy between what the king of Babylon aspired to and what he actually got. Verse 12, "How you have fallen from heaven, morning star, son of the dawn. You have been cast down to the earth, you who once laid low the nations. You said in your heart, 'I will ascend to the heavens. I will raise my throne above the stars of God. I will sit enthroned on the Mount of Assembly, on the utmost heights of Mount Zaphon. I will ascend above the tops of the clouds. I will make myself like the Most High.' But you are brought down to the realm of the dead, to the depths of the pit." Where have we heard this before? At the Tower of Babel back in Genesis 11. The first manifestation of Babylon. Let us build a city with a tower that reaches to the heavens to make a name for ourselves. Why should God reign on high? Let's get ourselves up there. Let's get ourselves on the throne. That is the spirit of Babylon. It's the same spirit that drives so many people in this world. It's the spirit that leads to a terrible fall in the end. We might wonder about some of the descriptions here. In verse 12, for example, why is the king of Babylon referred to as morning star, son of the dawn? Well, no doubt that is how he thought of himself. As the heavenly body that shone brighter than anybody else. Maybe he even seemed to be that way for a time. In the book of Daniel, King Nebuchadnezzar of Babylon tells us how he thought of himself. As he looked out over his realm, he said to himself, "Is not this the great Babylon I have built as the royal residence by my mighty power and for the glory of my majesty?" The Roman Emperor Augustus Caesar was proclaimed as divine Augustus Caesar, son of a god, imperator of land and sea, the benefactor and savior of the whole world. We could list plenty of other rulers who've showed that same spirit of Babylon. That same high and exalted opinion of themselves. That same ambition to ascend to the heavens and take God's throne. It's the spirit at the heart of the other city. And it's not limited to human pride. Some people have wondered if these verses describe the initial fall of Satan, the devil. Well, that is very unlikely, because in the context they're describing the fall of a human ruler. But there is no doubt Satan takes his place in Babylon. He is part of that city that opposes God, along with every spiritual power that sides with Satan. They're part of Babylon too. The Bible doesn't have much, if anything, to say about Satan's initial fall, but it is very clear that his end, his final downfall, will be as humiliating and as deep as the downfall described here. But you and I mustn't think this pride is limited to just the devil and a few crazy dictators. Certainly, we can say the main message here is that we shouldn't fear those who try to make themselves God. We certainly shouldn't put our hope in them either, because they're going to fall far and they're going to fall hard. That is the main message for us to take from this. But the other message here is, don't let this spirit of Babylon take root in your own heart. When you make plans for your future, when you daydream about your future, when you nurture ambitions, when you do that, don't leave God out of the picture. And don't give him second place in the picture either. If you do, that's a sure sign you are starting to plan as if you're the one on the throne. When we leave God out of the picture, it means we've already started to imagine ourselves in his place. As if we can make it all happen. And the bad news here is, if you are not a Christian, this spirit of Babylon is already ruling your heart. You're already part of this other city that opposes God, that aspires to take his place. And you might react to that by saying, no, I'm not. I never think of myself as ascending to heaven and taking God's place. Maybe not. But the pride we're talking about here doesn't have to show itself in grand schemes for world domination. This pride is simply placing myself and what I want at the center of things. For some people, that will prompt them, yes, to try and take over the world. But for most people, it just prompts them to rule their own little bit of the world. But it's the same pride behind it all. The pride that says, I am the master of my fate. I am the captain of my soul. I will make a name for myself. If you have not yet come to God through his son Jesus, if you have not bowed to Jesus as king of your life, then you have not yet surrendered your claim to the throne. The spirit of Babylon is king of your life. There cannot be two morning stars. And we're all born thinking of ourselves as the morning star, the brightest light in our own little horizon. If you want a simple proof of that, anytime you're shown a group photo, whose face do you look for first? Your own. Every time. We're all born thinking we are the morning star of our little world. But that is a miserable delusion. It's miserable because life becomes then a constant fight to assert ourselves, to assert our brightness and our glory and our strength and our beauty, to convince people of all those things about us. It's miserable. And it's a miserable delusion because there is only one morning star. And it's not any of us. The Bible ends with Jesus Christ declaring himself to be the bright morning star. How did Jesus rise to that position? Well, it was not by grasping after a place on heaven's throne. Jesus already had that place. That place was his from eternity past. But Jesus, who was God the Son, left heaven's throne. He came to earth to do his Father's will. And he was obedient all the way to death on a cross. Jesus did not have a drop of the spirit of Babel in him. He didn't have an ounce of that spirit in him. But Jesus voluntarily went down to the depths of the pit, right down into death, to rescue a people for God. He is now raised as King of the New Jerusalem. Jesus Christ is the true morning star. He is the brightest light in the city of God. And the way into that city is to stop trying to be the star yourself. Instead, worship Jesus as your king. Live to serve the true star of the show. The only star that will never fall. And that is so freeing. To stop fighting to try and make the world bow to us and love us. And instead to find our place in the glory of the true morning star. That's freedom for us. And those of us who have done that, still, let's keep this picture in our minds. And when we feel some of the arrogance of Babylon rising in our hearts, and don't we all feel it at times? In one way or another, when we feel that Babylonian ambition rising in us and stirring in us, not to just do our best in God's service, but to make our name for ourselves, to be the star. When we catch ourselves feeling that way, let's remember how that story ends. It ends in a great fall. It ends in desolation. From verse 16 onwards in Isaiah 14, we're told about the final humiliation of the king of Babylon. Not even a grand tomb remains to mark his achievements. No descendants remain to carry on his great project. It's summed up in verse 22. I will rise up against them, declares the Lord Almighty. I will wipe out Babylon's name and survivors, her offspring and descendants, declares the Lord. I will turn her into a place for owls and into swampland. I will sweep her with the broom of destruction, declares the Lord Almighty. We've seen how the book of Revelation confirms that future for Babylon. The other city has been around since the beginning, since Babel. But the Bible assures us its days are numbered. Its glory will be swept away like dust on the floor. Thank God there's another city, the city of God. Thank God we can take our place in that city, not through our great achievements, but through the work of Jesus Christ, the one who took all of our sinful pride upon himself and was punished for it so we could be forgiven, so we could truly be raised up through the grace and love of God. If you're not already a part of that other city, the city of God, you can enter the city today through simple faith in Jesus. Let's respond together by worshiping the true morning star, Jesus Christ. The song is, All My Days I Will Sing This Song of Gladness. Worthy is the Lamb who was slain to receive power and wealth and wisdom and strength and honor and glory and praise. Lord God, thank you that we can lay down our own foolish attempts to reign and to be the star. We can take our place worshiping the true star, your Son. Amen.